Picture for a second, the most idyllic outdoor towns in America.
Oh, yeah. The absolute dream destination.
Right, exactly. You know the ones, the places you might vacation to ski in the winter or maybe hike and mountain bike in the summer.
The ones with the pristine mountain views.
Yeah, the pristine views, the quaint downtowns, those really high-end gear shops.
Yeah.
But then as you're, walking down that picturesque main street, you notice something that's just, well, it's jarring.
Right.
The local restaurants are closed on a Tuesday and Wednesday. The ski lodges are drastically understaffed. The lift lines are just crawling.
And, your first instinct is probably to assume, oh, nobody wants to work anymore.
Exactly. But the reality is far more complicated. And honestly, it's highly ironic. The workers exist. The jobs definitely exist.
They absolutely do.
But the workers literally have nowhere to sleep. And the one place they actually can sleep, which happens to be, their own vehicles, is being actively criminalized by the exact same towns that desperately need those workers to show up for their shifts.
Yeah, I mean, it is a profound structural paradox. We are looking at a situation where the foundational workforce of these multi-million dollar tourism economies is just being legislated out of existence by local zoning ordinances and parking bans.
And that tension is the core mission of our deep dive today. We're exploring the collision between America's booming outdoor tourism economies and this, frankly, unprecedented workforce housing
It
crisis.
really is unprecedented.
It is. And specifically, we have a fascinating piece of source material to guide us today. It's an April 2026 document titled Memo 005.
Right. Written by Mike Isaacs.
Yes, Mike Isaacs, the founder of Timber Outdoor. Our goal here is to examine his analysis of why communities seem to be rejecting the very solutions that could, actually save their local businesses.
And I think it's important to clarify up front that as we go through this, we will be looking closely at the arguments laid out in his memo.
Definitely.
We're keeping in mind that these are the author's personal conclusions, right? His own policy theories based on the data he's compiled. We're just here to report on his findings.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this, starting at the absolute ground level. Rather than looking at macroeconomic theory right away, let's look at what this crisis actually forces a bootstrapping small business owner to do just to survive.
Yeah, the symptoms of this crisis are definitely felt most acutely, not in city halls, but, in kitchens and the stockrooms of local businesses.
Right.
The memo introduces us to a restaurateur named Zinzi Shamanafard. She is the owner of a restaurant called Hidden Cuisine in Moab, Utah.
And the ordeal she went through is just staggering. According to the document, she spent 2 years, like 24 entire months, navigating permits, engineering surveys, and fighting with the Utah Department of Transportation.
2 whole years.
Yeah. And if you hear that, you probably assume she was trying to build, I don't know, a massive commercial annex or some multi-story apartment complex.
Right, some huge development.
But she wasn't. She was literally just trying to build 5 RV parking pads with electrical hookups behind her kitchen.
Wow.
Just 5 spots, so her kitchen staff had a legal piece of dirt to park on and sleep.
And the author notes she started this process 6 years ago, driven by pure operational desperation.
Desperation is the word, yeah.
Because she was trapped in this recurring cycle. She would find a great employee, spend the resources to train them, build a solid working relationship, and then inevitably lose them.
And not because of bad pay, right?
Like, she didn't lose them because she was underpitched them or because the working conditions were poor. She lost them because there was physically nowhere in all of Moab for that employee to affordably reside.
That's just wild.
Zinzi is not a housing developer. She's a small business owner who completely ran out of options.
It's an incredible burden to place on a local entrepreneur. It's like trying to open a bakery, but before you can sell a single croissant, the city tells you that you first have to personally cultivate the wheat farm
Right.
and then build the flour mill and pave the supply road. You just want to bake bread, but suddenly you are forced to become an amateur urban planner and a real estate developer just to keep your doors open.
What's fascinating here is how the burden of municipal infrastructure, like the basic housing that a town actually relies on to function, has been entirely offloaded onto the shoulders of hospitality small businesses.
It really has.
If we look at the broader data the memo provides for Moab, the systemic nature of this failure becomes undeniable. There was a 2023 housing plan commissioned by Grand County that surveyed 90 local employers.
Okay.
They found that 88.9% of those employers experienced significant difficulty fully staffing their companies because of the lack of affordable workforce housing.
Wait, I want to dwell on that number for a second. 88.9%.
Yeah, basically 90%.
If you are walking down Main Street in Moab, essentially 9 out of every 10 businesses you pass, the coffee shop, the bike rental place, the grocery store, they literally cannot fully staff their operations. It's a town running on fumes.
And the subsequent statistic in that report is even more illustrative of the underlying mechanics. Of those 90 employers, 76.7% reported that they had actually lost existing workers to the housing shortage.
Oh, wow. So not just failing to hire new people.
Exactly. This is a crucial distinction. They didn't just fail to recruit new talent. The workers were already there. They had the job. They were actively contributing to the local economy.
Right.
And the business lost them strictly because the worker could not maintain a roof over their head.
They bled the talent they already had. The memo cites the Moab Times detailing exactly what that looks like on the ground, and it cuts across every profession.
Every single one.
We are talking about critical infrastructure here. Nurses living in vans, school district staff renting spots in long-term campgrounds, public agencies that can't deliver basic municipal services because their departments are perpetually understaffed.
It touches everything.
Even the Moab City Police Chief, Brett Edge, went on the record calling for a paradigm shift. He explicitly stated that the crisis is impossible to manage around anymore and that the city has to take ownership of the issue.
And the author also highlights a KSL television report from October 2024 that really encapsulates this shift in the entrepreneurial mindset.
Oh, yeah, that quote was striking.
Right. A Moab business owner who already maintains company housing for approximately 60 workers explained the new fundamental math of starting a business in an outdoor town.
Okay, what did they say?
They said, before you even write a business plan, before you ask if a product idea is viable, you have to take a step back and ask, where are these people going to live?
That is a fundamental rewrite of American small business. Where are these people going to live? It's not about your profit margin on a mountain bike rental or a plate of food anymore.
Not at all.
The primary constraint on your business is residential zoning. And when grassroots operators like Zinzi can't fix it, you start to wonder if the municipal governments or the mega resorts can step in and solve it at scale.
Which brings us to the macro level.
Exactly. Because as the memo points out, Moab is not an isolated incident. Let's look at the sheer scale of the math when this hits a massive regional economy like Jackson Hole, Wyoming.
The financial realities in Jackson Hole really just defy comprehension. A regional housing needs assessment, which was presented to elected officials across both Wyoming and Idaho, found that vacancy rates across the entire Teton region are at essentially zero.
Zero.
Literally zero. A consultant explicitly told officials that people attempting to relocate to fill local jobs literally cannot find an open unit, regardless of price.
Zero vacancy. So the physical inventory just does not exist.
It doesn't.
And that assessment calculated that the region needs to build 5,300 housing units to address the current crisis. But here is the number that completely stops you in your tracks.
Yeah, brace yourself for this one.
The public investment cost to build those 5,300 units is estimated at roughly $2.2 billion. Wait, $2.2 billion.
Billion with a B.
The memo points out that is 25 years of the combined annual budgets of Teton County and the town of Jackson. How can any local government actually solve a math problem that big?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the author's central thesis is that they simply can't.
They just can't do it.
A local municipality cannot outspend a multi-billion dollar gap. You could take every single tax dollar collected for police, roads, and parks, spend it exclusively on housing, and it would still take a quarter of a century to build what they need today.
That's insane.
Which is why major employers are abandoning traditional hiring practices. The Jackson Hole Chamber of Commerce surveyed 240 businesses, and the vast majority pointed to housing as the sole driver of their inability to operate.
The sole driver.
The labor shortage caused multiple businesses to limit hours or shutter entirely during peak summer seasons. Even the superintendent of Grand Teton National Park stated that housing, not federal wages, not working conditions, but physical housing, had become their primary constraint for hiring.
I mean, if the federal government is struggling to house its national park rangers, the local ski shop clearly has zero chance.
Right. Absolutely zero.
Which brings us to how the massive corporate resorts try to force their way out of this. The memo uses Telluride, Colorado as an example. Telluride Ski Resort, which is the town's largest employer, actually built a dedicated workforce housing facility.
And it was a big one, right?
Yeah, it's called Big Billy's Apartments, featuring 146 units, but it was entirely full before the ski season even officially began.
Their institutional housing was exhausted immediately.
Immediately.
So the resort had to aggressively enter the private residential market, literally purchasing and leasing single-family homes in the area just to keep their chairlifts running.
And even that corporate buying power wasn't enough. The author mentions a worker named Zach Watkins. He's a regional mogul coach.
Oh, right. His story is wild.
He secured the job, but found himself completely stranded upon arrival. He was quoted saying he couldn't even find a place to park a trailer if he managed to buy one.
And not a single spot.
The spokesperson for Telluride Ski Resort publicly admitted they lose employees every single day strictly because of this bottleneck. So, if big money can't build its way out of a $2.2 billion gap, and mega resorts can't buy their way out, what happens when a community tries a grassroots scrappy approach?
Yeah, what happens when they actually try something realistic?
Exactly. What happens when a town actually tries to implement a temporary, practical solution?
Well, that leads to perhaps the most sobering section of the document. The author takes us to Sedona, Arizona, to observe a local policy failure.
And we really need to look at the numbers here.
First, we need to establish the economic baseline in Sedona. According to the data Isaacs presents, the average rent in the city starts at $1,800 a month. However, the average worker income in the area is only between $1,100 and $1,800 a month.
So if you are a worker on the lower end of that spectrum, rent consumes literally 100% of your take-home pay.
100%.
You have absolutely no money left for food, gas, or insurance.
And entering the housing market as a buyer is mathematically impossible.
Oh, forget about it.
The median home price in Sedona reached $971,000. That is a 50% increase just since 2020.
Almost $1 million for a median home.
The fundamental municipal math is broken. As the local mayor, Scott Jablow, noted to FOX 10 Phoenix, local businesses were complaining that their employees were resorting to sleeping in the national forest.
Wow.
And then getting roused by police because of fire hazards. The mayor frankly admitted the city had, quote, ran out of ideas.
But they did manage to find one idea, right? In March 2024, the Sedona City Council voted to create a program called Safe Place to Park.
Yes, they did.
And let's look at the mechanics of this, because the memo makes a very specific point of outlining how pragmatic it was. This was not a permanent housing structure. It wasn't a free handout.
No, not at all.
It was a designated, legal, overnight vehicle parking area equipped with showers, restrooms, and on-site management. And it was strictly verified. You could only use it if you could prove you were locally employed.
In a public outreach effort, actually identified 32 people already living in their vehicles while working full-time in Sedona.
Full-time workers.
We are talking about employees at Whole Foods, Safeway, spas, coffee houses, and pizza shops.
The people running the town.
Exactly. The workers themselves testified. One individual wrote to the council that their rent had jumped 35% in 2 years. Another described the daily routine of having to shower at a local gym before clocking into the supermarket.
This even got national coverage in the Washington Post. And as the memo emphasizes, these workers were not demanding subsidized apartments. They just wanted a legal patch of asphalt to park their cars overnight without being ticketed.
Just a safe place to sleep.
Yeah, so they could wake up and go to the jobs they already had. The city council looks at this pragmatic proposal, and they pass the Safe Place to Park program by a landslide vote of 6-1.
A huge margin.
Huge. They even funded it with an $875,000 outside grant, meaning it wasn't even draining the local taxpayer coffers.
Right. The mechanism was in place, it was fully funded and legally approved. But then, the residents of Sedona gathered signatures, forced the issue onto the November 2024 ballot as a referendum, and the voters overturned the program.
They just killed it.
They completely dismantled it.
Here's where it gets really interesting. You have to ask why. During the initial city council phase, the Washington Post published a quote from a local resident urging support for the program.
Yeah, what did they say?
The resident said, "These are people who work in our town and we all depend on them. We must support them. Denying this program will not make our homeless population go away. Let's give them a ray of hope."
That's a powerful statement.
It is, but the broader voting base explicitly rejected that plea.
And to understand that voter backlash, we have to look at the psychology of the local property owners, which the author really unpacks here.
Yeah, the memo gets deep into this.
You have homeowners who bought into a community where the median home is nearly $1 million. They expect a certain aesthetic and a specific pristine environment. In their minds, a parking lot full of people living in cars isn't associated with the barista or the grocery clerk. It's associated with urban blight. They feared a drop in property values and an aesthetic degradation of their resort town.
Which leads to Mike Isaacs' core conclusion in the memo. He writes that a city council successfully identified the problem, designed a highly targeted solution, and funded it entirely with outside grant money.
A perfect policy setup, basically.
Yeah, perfect. Yet the community voted to enforce the suffering rather than accept the visible reality of their own workforce. Isaacs calls this, quote, a values crisis wearing a housing crisis's clothes.
Wow. A values crisis.
The community literally voted to banish the people who pour their coffee and maintain their hiking trails because they didn't like how the solution looked. Which brings us to the ultimate collision between municipal regulations and worker survival strategies.
Why the immediate reflex to ban mobile workers instead of integrating them? To grasp that, the memo asks us to fundamentally reframe how we view vehicle dwelling in these hyper-expensive areas. Let's return to Moab for a moment.
Okay.
According to the Grand County Housing Plan, a household needs to earn roughly $147,746 annually to afford the median home there.
Almost $150,000 a year on a hospitality wage. That is statistically absurd.
It is absurd if you are trapped in the conventional rental market, where every dollar you earn goes to a landlord. But the author argues vehicle dwelling entirely changes that financial trajectory.
How so?
For these specific workers, living in a van or a truck is not a permanent end-of-life goal. It is a highly strategic financial bridge.
A bridge?
Yes. If a worker arrives for a season, lives in their vehicle, and reduces their housing costs to near zero, they can save money at a vastly accelerated rate.
That makes sense.
The memo calculates that in just 18 months of disciplined saving under this model, a hospitality worker could actually accumulate a meaningful down payment to eventually buy into the housing market.
So the vehicle is the strategy, not the destination.
Exactly.
But I want to play devil's advocate here for a second, because the towns aren't just acting out of pure malice, right?
Sure.
The municipal math is complicated. The memo acknowledges that local governments have genuine administrative concerns regarding sanitation, public safety, and, most importantly, property taxes.
Oh, the tax issue is huge.
It is. Think about how a town functions. The roads are paved, the water pipes are maintained, and the schools are funded largely by property taxes.
Right.
If a quarter of your workforce lives in vans, they have no fixed address. They aren't paying into the property tax base that supports the very infrastructure they are driving on. From a purely functional standpoint, isn't that a valid reason for a local government to push back?
This raises an important question, and the author tackles that jurisdictional friction directly.
Okay.
The memo concedes that a person living in a van lacks what we call a jurisdictional hook.
A jurisdictional hook.
Right. They are effectively off the municipal grid, which is a genuine administrative problem for a city planner. But Isaacs argues that this absence of a tax relationship is a reason to invent a new regulatory framework, not a reason to ban the human being entirely.
Okay, so if they aren't paying property tax, how do you integrate them? What does a new framework actually look like?
It looks like establishing a light adaptive system. Instead of property taxes, you implement a mobile resident permit or a monthly municipal parking fee.
Oh, interesting.
Right. This creates a trackable fee-paying connection between the mobile resident and the city services they consume. It pays for the trash collection and the road maintenance.
That seems so simple.
The legislative tools to integrate these workers absolutely exist, but the political will to use them does not. Because, as the memo points out, passing an ordinance to ban overnight parking doesn't actually make the workers disappear.
No, of course not.
It doesn't magically construct a single new unit of affordable housing. And it certainly doesn't reduce the town's massive demand for low-wage labor.
No, it just forces the workforce into the shadows. Like the Sedona mayor pointed out, it pushes them into the national forest where the police have to wake them up at 2 a.m. because their camp stoves are a fire hazard.
And the memo's ultimate point is that these vehicle bans are not solving public safety or sanitation problems. What they actually accomplish is protecting the aesthetic sensibilities of existing property owners.
It's all about the aesthetics.
And providing political cover for local officials who find it easier to outlaw a complex reality than to actively manage it. The author asserts that while preserving a town's aesthetics is a legitimate interest, it completely fails when weighed against the fundamental economic viability of the community.
I mean, think about the implication here for you listening right now. If you love visiting these outdoor heavens, the author is pointing out that these communities are actively dismantling themselves.
They really are.
Every link in this chain is a deliberate policy choice. The refusal to zone for high-density housing is a choice. The ordinance that makes it illegal for a worker to sleep in their own van is a choice. The ballot referendum in Sedona was a choice.
All choices.
Isaacs argues that the towns that finally adapt to this reality, the ones that build those permit systems and safe parking zones, will have open restaurants, staffed ski lifts, and thriving local economies.
Exactly.
The ones that refuse to adapt, the ones that fiercely cling to these aesthetic bans, are just going to be left with empty storefronts, closed trails, and decades of pointless committee reports wondering where all the workers went.
And furthermore, the parking ban, according to the author's analysis, doesn't just remove a physical place to park. It actively destroys the only viable savings mechanism available to a working person in that hyperinflated market.
It takes away the bridge.
It does. It traps them in poverty rather than offering a bridge out of it.
So what does this all mean? As we look to wrap up, the core argument of Memo 0055, which, by the way, heavily teases a follow-up document called Memo 006 regarding a private sector concept called Prosperity Place, is that there has to be a foundational shift in how we view the workforce.
A total paradigm shift.
Communities must stop criminalizing the adaptive survival strategies of the very people who keep their local economies running. The survival of America's outdoor towns depends entirely on integration. It requires building light regulatory frameworks and basic infrastructure rather than relying on endless exclusion and bans.
And taking all the data presented in this memo, it leaves you with a really profound thought to consider.
What's that?
If the teachers, the nurses, the rescue workers, and the cooks are systematically zoned and legislated out of a town boundaries, at what point does that location cease to be an actual community and simply become an exclusive, hollowed-out resort pretending to be a town?
Wow. That is a brilliant and, frankly, devastating question to leave on. A hollowed-out resort pretending to be a town. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the hidden systems behind the places you love to visit, and we'll catch you on the next one.